right, all right. Welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show. That's right. I'm back alive. Live and alive, okay? And that's actually I consider a really good thing. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Andy Worthington, longtime journalist and one of the main people fighting for 17 years around the Guantanamo torture chamber. And now, what we are going to do is we're going to listen to a piece from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the author of A New Synthesis of Communism, The New Communism. And he's talking about something called the Five Stops. Why this system that rules over the world right now, cannot be reformed. And it's from a piece called Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. And I really want to emphasize that people listen to this piece, the five stops, the things that are endemic to. They're actually just part of the being of this system and what it means. What it means that for the people that are trying to live under this and what it means for changing. So let's get moving with this. This is the five stops from Bob Avakian.
Only an actual revolution can bring about the fundamental change that is needed. In 2012, in Revolution Nothing Less, I talked about the outrageous murder of Romarley Graham earlier that same year, shot down in his own house in the Bronx by the New York City police. He was only 18 years old. Do I have to tell you what race he was? His mother kept saying, "This has to stop." And his father repeated over and over, "Why did they kill my son? Why did they kill my son?" New York cops then loudly rallied around their fellow pig who murdered Romarley in cold blood, viciously taunting Romarley's family and loved ones, demonstrating yet one more time the ugly truth that in the way this country has been built, and for the powers that be in this country, the humanity of black people has never counted for anything. They have never been valued as human beings, but only as things to be exploited, oppressed, and repressed. 6 years later, and with cold-blooded murders by police continuing in an unbroken chain, I will say again now what I said then. How many more times does this have to happen? How many more times do the tears and the cries of anguish and anger have to pour forth from the wounded hearts of people? How many more times, when another of these outrageous murders is perpetrated by the police, do we have to hear those words that pour gasoline on the already burning wounds? Justifiable homicide, justified use of force by police. How many more? Romarley Graham, Nicholas Hayward Jr., Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, Darius Pinex, Oscar Grant, Manuel Diaz, Joel Acevedo, Laquan McDonald, Ayanna Stanley Jones, Sandra Bland, Jack Sun, Rennie Davis, Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, Maurice Granton, Harith Augustus. The list goes on and on and on. Thousands and thousands, especially black and Latino and Native American. If this were the only thing wrong with this system, it would be more than enough reason to sweep it off the earth. But this is only part of the intolerable outrages that are continually perpetrated by this system and that cause so much unnecessary suffering for the masses of humanity. So let's go back to why and what it will take to make all the outrages really stop. Why are black people, Latinos, and Native Americans subjected to genocidal persecution, mass incarceration, police brutality, and murder? Why is there the patriarchal degradation, dehumanization, and subjugation of all women everywhere, and oppression based on gender or sexual orientation? Why are there wars of empire, armies of occupation, and crimes against humanity? Why is there the demonization, criminalization, and deportations of immigrants and the militarization of the border? Why is the environment of our planet being destroyed? These are what we call the five stops, deep and defining contradictions of this system. With all the destruction and suffering they cause, which must be protested and resisted in a powerful way, with a real determination to stop them, but which can only be finally ended by putting an end to this system itself. Why, along with all this, do we live in a world where large parts of humanity live in stark poverty, with 2.3 billion people lacking even rudimentary toilets or latrines, and huge numbers suffering from preventable diseases, with millions of children dying every year from these diseases and from starvation, while 150 million children in the world are forced to engage in ruthlessly exploited child labor. And the whole world economy rests on a vast network of sweatshops, employing large numbers of women who are regularly subjected to sexual harassment and assault. A world where 65 million refugees have been displaced by war, poverty, persecution, and the effects of global warming. Why is this the state of humanity? There is one fundamental reason. The basic nature of the system of capitalism, imperialism that we live under, and the way, because of its very nature, it continually perpetrates and perpetuates horror after horror. And in fundamental terms, we have two choices. Either live with all this and condemn future generations to the same or worse, if they have a future at all, or make revolution. But what is the scientific basis for saying that this system is the source of all this? That it is built into this system, and therefore it is impossible to do away with these outrages through reforming this system, and instead it must be overthrown. Let's go back to those five stops. The oppression of black people and other people of color. This system in this country was founded in genocide and slavery. From the beginning, African Americans and Native Americans were treated as pariahs, a caste of people less than human and not deserving of the same rights and opportunities as the European settlers of the territory. White supremacy was poured into the foundation and into every institution of the country. The uniting of the United States was accomplished through the compromise written into the founding constitution that institutionalized slavery. And for generations, slave labor produced a great part of the wealth of this country. As I said in Basics 1-1, there would be no United States as we now know it today without slavery. That is a simple and basic truth. And then, when it was no longer possible to contain the conflicts that had been somewhat held in check by the founding compromise, the Civil War erupted between the Southern slave states and the northern states, which increasingly were based on the exploitation of wage labor by capitalists. But shortly after the end of this civil war, another compromise was engineered, which was a continuation of the original compromise under the new conditions. The country was put back together on the basis of reaffirming and reinforcing white supremacy. With the masses of black people still overwhelmingly in the South, subjugated and terrorized into second-class citizen status, exploited in conditions of near slavery and sometimes still literal slavery by white plantation and other property owners. And the land and way of life of the native peoples was further stolen through armed conquest and decimated by slaughter, confinement in reservations, and cultural genocide, which has resulted in the poverty, oppression, and repression that continues to be inflicted on Native Americans to this day. Under slavery, it was the armed patrols and militias organized by the slave owners that hunted down slaves who rebelled or just tried to escape and terrorized the masses of black people as a whole. After slavery, with Jim Crow segregation, it was the Ku Klux Klan, together with local sheriffs, who largely played this role. Today, in the conditions in which masses of black people in the ghettos of the inner cities find themselves, the role that was played in the past by the slave patrols and then the Ku Klux Klan and local sheriffs is now carried out by heavily armed urban police forces. This is a big part of the overall role of the police, which, as I said in Basics 124, is not to serve and protect the people. It is to serve and protect the system that rules over the people, to enforce the relations of exploitation and oppression, the conditions of poverty, misery, and degradation into which the system has cast people and is determined to keep people in. The law and order the police are about, with all their brutality and murder, is the law and order that enforces all this oppression and madness. In the days of slavery and then Jim Crow segregation after the Civil War, the oppressors viciously exploited and terrorized black people, brutally murdering those they saw as posing a threat or not staying in their place. But they did not kill off or incarcerate a huge part of the black population because their labor was needed as a backbone and crucial source of profit for the cotton plantations and the overall economy in the South and the country as a whole. Today, with great numbers of black people concentrated in the inner cities, and with many factories and other capitalist enterprises having moved away from the urban cores, the police have killed thousands of black people in the last few decades, and they play a key part in forcibly maintaining masses of black people in a situation where, especially youth, robbed of any decent future under this system, are killing each other in the thousands, and millions are either incarcerated or in some other way under the control of the so-called justice system. Because white supremacy is such a defining part of this country, it is not just African Americans and Native Americans, but people of color generally who are subjected to discrimination, degradation, and brutality. And this applies now in acute ways to those whose roots lie in Mexico, El Salvador, and other parts of Central America and the Caribbean, which are tightly ensnared in a net of domination and exploitation by the imperialists of the USA, whose ravaging of these countries has driven many to emigrate to the US itself. White supremacy and capitalism, they have been completely interwoven and tightly stitched together through the whole development of this country down to today. To attempt to really put an end to white supremacy while maintaining the system of capitalism would tear the entire fabric of the country apart. White supremacy and capitalism. It is not possible to overcome and finally abolish the one without overthrowing and finally abolishing the other. The oppression of women and oppressive gender relations. Not only is white supremacy completely interwoven and tightly stitched together with the development of capitalism in this country, but male supremacy is also completely interwoven and tightly stitched together with the whole historical development of the division between exploiters and exploited, oppressors and oppressed throughout the world, including the capitalist imperialist system which is dominant in the world today. Thousands of years ago, with the development of human societies in such a way that means of production, land, domesticated animals, tools, and so on, were no longer the common resource of people, but instead became privately owned. And with the division of labor resulting in women being responsible for child rearing and men dominating ownership of these means of production and wanting to pass this along to their male heirs and not someone else's, this led to the dominance of the patriarchal family, with the man having power over his wife or wives and children, and women in society overall being subordinate to men, with all the brutality and terror, both mental and physical, that has been used to enforce this, and the whole ideology and culture of male supremacy and misogyny, regarding women as lesser, despised beings whose essential purpose is to serve men, that has rationalized and reinforce this inequality and oppression. This patriarchal oppression has also been bound up with the suppression and punishment of relations among people, including intimate relations, that run counter to and challenge traditional gender relations. It is crucial that there be determined struggle against this terrible oppression in all of its manifestations. But in order to finally abolish and move beyond all this, in society as a whole, and not just in one country, but for all of humanity, it is necessary to abolish the private ownership of the means of production, converting them into the common property of the people as a whole, and to replace the traditional patriarchal family with relations among people, including intimate relations, that are freely entered into and freed from all vestiges of oppression. This, of course, is impossible under capitalism. Only through the revolution to overthrow this system and uproot all relations of exploitation and oppression that are embodied in this system will it be possible to finally end the fundamental division in which half of humanity is subordinated to and dominated by the other half, and all the brutality and agony bound up with that. This is why, in the new socialist society that will be brought into being with the overthrow of capitalism, the goal, as set forth in the Constitution for the new socialist republic in North America, must be to overcome all traditions chains embodied in traditional gender roles and divisions, and all the oppressive relations bound up with this in every sphere of society, and to enable women as fully as men to take part in and contribute to every aspect of the struggle to transform society and the world in order to uproot and abolish all relations of oppression and exploitation and emancipate humanity as a whole.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and we're listening to Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And what we're listening to is a piece called The Five Stops, Why This System Can't Be Reformed. It's a clip from the film Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution.
Wars of empire, armies of occupation, and crimes against humanity. Raiding and other forms of violent conflict between different peoples can be found going back to early societies long ago. But the emergence of class-divided societies and civilizations based on conquest, slavery, and other forms of exploitation and oppression, has for millennia led to wars that have caused death and destruction on a massive scale. This has been especially so once the production and exchange of commodities, things produced for exchange rather than for direct use by those who produce them, developed on a large scale, and means of transport were developed that enabled commodities to be exchanged and markets for exchange to be actively sought over a large and increasingly expanding territory. Wars were then fought to conquer markets and trade routes, as well as sources of raw materials, and to enslave and exploit conquered peoples. With the development of capitalism over the past several centuries, commodity production and exchange has been greatly extended to become the generalized way in which production and exchange has been carried out. If you think about it, all the things that you use, or almost all of them, you do not make them yourself. You exchange something, namely money, to buy them from some other source. And this is what people all over the world are now doing. This is what capitalism has generalized. And capitalism has more and more tightly bound things together under its domination into an overall world system. But this system of capitalist imperialism is marked by profound divisions between different classes and groups of people within each country, between a small number of capitalist imperialist countries and the countries under the domination of these imperialists, particularly in the third world, that is Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, and Asia, and divisions between imperialist countries themselves, whose rivalry has revolved to a significant degree around their contention for control of colonies and people to exploit in the third world. And when, for a time in the last century, there were socialist countries, first in the Soviet Union and then also in China, there was a conflict between the imperialist powers and those socialist countries, which the imperialists worked to isolate, suffocate, and destroy. All this led to two world wars in the last century, in which tens of millions of people were killed, including huge numbers of civilians. Since the end of World War II in 1945, the divisions that marked the world within the overall framework of domination by the capitalist imperialist system have led to continual wars. Wars where imperialist powers have unleashed massive violence against people fighting for liberation from imperialism in countries of the third world, such as the war in Vietnam, where the U.S. slaughtered several million Vietnamese and poisoned much of the soil of that country with chemical weapons. War crimes and crimes against humanity that the U.S. imperialists have continued in all parts of the world, including today, for example, in the Middle Eastern country of Yemen, where because of bombing and other actions by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, backed, armed, and aided by the U.S., 1 million people, including large numbers of children, are suffering and many are dying from the terrible disease cholera, and 8 million people, more than a fourth of the population, are facing starvation. And there are wars between different oppressive forces, including wars where imperialist powers fight each other not directly, but through proxies, such as the war which has devastated Syria over the past several years, where the U.S. and Russia have backed, armed, and aided different factions. While another world war, which especially with the arsenals of nuclear weapons in the hands of the U.S. and Russia, China, and some other countries, could lead to destruction and death on a massive scale, and could even bring about the extinction of the human race, while this has so far been avoided, so long as the capitalist imperialist system continues to dominate the world, and the profound divisions this embodies and enforces continue to exist, the danger remains of a far more devastating war than anything previously endured by humanity. Only through the overthrow of this system, including in its greatest centers of power in the imperialist countries themselves, an overthrow carried out also with the aim of preventing these imperialists from launching an all-out war of annihilation. Only in this way can we advance toward the goal of overcoming the divisions among human beings that embody exploitation and oppression and lead to violent conflict, and finally make a reality of the dreams and aspirations of so many for a world without war. The demonization, criminalization, and deportations of immigrants and the militarization of the border. The borders of this country were first established through war and repeatedly expanded through armed conquest of land, especially in wars against the native peoples and a war against Mexico in the middle of the 19th century. This war resulted in over half the territory of Mexico coming under the control of the U.S., and it was fought on the U.S. side for the purpose of expanding slavery, as well as greatly enlarging its territory. Since the end of the 19th century, the U.S. empire has been expanded not only by seizing countries such as the Philippines, Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Guam as colonies or near colonies, but also through invasions and other means, installing rulers dependent on and obedient to the U.S. Today, the U.S. has military forces and intelligence operatives stationed in over 100 countries around the world, and it provides military backing and other aid to governments, including brutally oppressive regimes that it maintains as part of the U.S. empire. And relying on its military as well as its economic power as coercion, U.S. imperialism not only continues to politically dominate, but to economically exploit and plunder countries throughout the Third World. Again, the countries of Latin America, and in particular Mexico, El Salvador, and other parts of Central America and the Caribbean, which the imperialists of the U.S. arrogantly regard as their backyard, have been the special targets of all this. Not only has the U.S. repeatedly carried out military invasions and coups there and backed murderous dictatorships with their bloodthirsty death squads terrorizing the people, but it has imposed economic agreements that have further bled these countries and intensified the misery of the masses of people there. For example, contrary to the lies spouted by Donald Trump, NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, engineered under Bill Clinton's presidency, has not resulted in the U.S. getting screwed, but has actually resulted in the ruin of large numbers of farmers in Mexico and increased the number of desperately poor people there, which has been a major factor in driving many people from Mexico to the United States. Trump only wants to make all this even worse. For all these reasons, along with other factors such as global warming and the accompanying crisis of water shortage in many countries, there are tens of millions of refugees in the world today, driven from their home countries and seeking asylum or simply a means to survive in the U.S. and in capitalist countries in Europe. And given all this, it is the height of hypocrisy and of cruelty for the U.S. government, and in particular the Trump-Pence regime, to talk about the right of countries to secure their borders and bray about building a wall to enforce this, let alone to denounce the masses of immigrants from a country like Mexico as rapists, drug dealers, and murderers, and to enact such barbaric measures as separating children, even very young children, from their parents if they are attempting to enter the U.S. without the required papers, and even if they are seeking asylum from persecution and violence. Here again, while determined and massive struggle needs to be waged against these inhuman actions by the U.S. and other oppressive governments, it should be clear that there can be no solution under the system of capitalism imperialism to the situation involving masses of immigrants and refugees. The only solution lies in the revolution to overthrow this system. A revolution aiming not just to abolish oppression, exploitation, poverty, and misery in one country, but having as its fundamental goal the abolition of all this throughout the world and the elimination of all borders and boundaries that erect walls between the different parts of humanity. The destruction of the planet by capitalism imperialism. The very fact that global warming is one of the major reasons why there are today a greater number of refugees, 65 million, than at any time since World War II, is one powerful indicator of the severity of the climate crisis, which is increasing in intensity at an accelerating rate. The scientific evidence is overwhelming. The climate crisis poses a very real and growing threat to human civilization. And human activity, in particular the production and use of oil and other fossil fuels, is a major cause of this intensifying crisis. The accelerated melting of the ice sheets in Antarctica, the destruction of vast expanses of rainforests, the despoiling of other key parts of the earth, including the oceans, with the terrible consequences for plant and animal species, which are also vital for human existence. All this can only continue and even further accelerate with human society under the domination of the capitalist imperialist system. Despite conferences and agreements which claim to be addressing this crisis, but which are dominated by the countries that are the biggest contributors to this crisis, despite talk and even some steps to develop sources of energy as alternatives to fossil fuels, despite all this, the very nature of the capitalist imperialist system dictates that competing capitalists controlling billions of dollars of investments, and the governments of the major world powers in particular, are compelled to contend with each other for markets, cheap labor and raw materials, including fossil fuels, and for control of strategic parts of the world. This leads not only to economic and political conflicts, but repeatedly to wars, which themselves have a devastating effect on the environment. And it is worth noting that the U.S. military is the single largest institutional consumer of oil in the world. To make matters even worse, this system has now brought forth a fascist regime to power in the U.S., which is determined to shatter agreements and roll back regulations that offer even minor, if completely insufficient, protections for the environment, and to unleash forces whose effect on the environment, if persisted in, could actually lead to the destruction of human civilization. Obviously, we have only one Earth as a home for humanity, and this climate crisis can only be fundamentally and ultimately addressed on a world scale. But a first great step, or leap, can be taken by wresting power from the capitalist imperialist system in its most powerful stronghold, and making this a source of inspiration and base of support for people around the world in rising up to overthrow and abolish all systems and relations of exploitation, oppression, plunder and destruction of the environment and of human beings who can only continue to exist and to thrive through a rational and planned interaction with the rest of nature. From all this, it stands out very sharply that we live in a grossly lopsided world, a world where a few dozen billionaires have as much wealth as the poorer half of humanity, and a small number of ruling classes in a small number of countries dominate, oppress, and control the destiny of the masses of humanity, with consequences that are already terrible and could before long become catastrophic. And in everything that I've been shining a light on regarding the world we live in under the domination of capitalism and imperialism, we are seeing the consequences of a system based on the private appropriation by competing centers of capital of wealth that is socially produced through networks of production involving vast numbers, ultimately billions of people all over the globe, who are forced now to work in conditions and relations of production that exploit and dehumanize them. It is not simply greed that drives these capitalists to constantly seek ways to more ruthlessly exploit people. It is the fact that if they do not do this, or if some other capitalists do it more successfully, that is, even more ruthlessly, then they will face the prospect of not just falling behind, but actually going under, eaten up by other capitalist sharks. It is the private appropriation of socially produced wealth and the anarchy, the feverish competition and contention that results from this, which ultimately underlies and drives all the horrors that are concentrated in the five stops and the conditions to which the masses of humanity are continually subjected. The solution is to replace this system of private appropriation with a system where the socially produced wealth is also socially appropriated by a government actually representing the masses of people instead of a class of capitalist exploiters. And this wealth is then utilized on the basis of conscious planning in the interests and for the benefit of the people of society and ultimately the whole world. How this can be done is spelled out in the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America. This is the fundamental difference between the society and world we have with the system of capitalism and imperialism that we are forced to live under, and the world we could have. The bridge between these two worlds is revolution, a real revolution. Let's be honest, this is a difficult road, but there is no other way to finally put an end to the horrors that are continually brought forth by this system. And as hard as this is, it is possible, if we go about it the right way, with the right outlook and approach, the right goals and methods, the right strategy and plan. So this is what I'm going to dig into through the course of this talk.
All right. Once again, that was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the author of A New Synthesis of Communism, The New Communism, and he's been talking on the five stops, why this system can't be reformed, from why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution. Guantanamo, 6,200 days in existence as of January 1st this year and approaching the 17th anniversary on January 11th. From the very beginning of this fascist hellhole, our guest Andy Worthington, a British journalist among many other things, has been out in front of waging a battle to shut this torture chamber down. Andy, welcome back.
Hi, Michael. It's very nice to be talking to you again.
Yeah, you too, man. Let's jump into this. Guantanamo still exists, but for many people, it remains a secret. And for others, they don't even know that it ever existed or what it is. Let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is that it's, you know, always been, a monstrous place, a place where the law and morality has kind of been discarded. And that ought to be something that should have troubled people from the very beginning. But, of course, you know, as we know, it took some time for really anyone to apart from the people who were most aware of what was going on, to realize what was happening. And then the years went by and, you know, we saw a bit of a pushback in the second term of George W. Bush. And then we had this, you know, great hope that was supposed to be offered by Barack Obama that he was going to close it. And that didn't happen. And now here we are, you know, 2 years into the Trump administration, and a place that remains as fundamentally unjust and as wrong as it was when it was set up has now almost disappeared from view, when the reality ought to be that the longer that a place of monstrous injustice stays open, the more people should care about it. So it's troubling how much it's disappeared.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things that really struck me when I was reading about this and came across the fact that you were going to be in this country now, and you were here particularly to speak to what's going on with Guantanamo now. One of the things that really got to me, though, was when I was thinking about this, that there's a whole generation of people who have no idea. I mean, even as we're talking and as you were describing it, they have no idea what really it is, where did it come from, and why? Because, you know, even if they hear about Guantanamo, it's not the same association as we have in terms of understanding and knowing and seeing what, and having lived through what this thing was and remains to this day to an even greater degree, I would think.
Well, I think so, yeah. I mean, I think the problem has always been that people were never very well informed in general, and that they didn't particularly, in general, demonstrate that much curiosity into finding out more. Because, you know, the bottom line that was taken by the Bush administration when they opened it was kind of, these are the bad guys, these are the worst of the worst, we're sorting it out, don't worry about it, kind of go back to sleep and we're keeping you safe kind of approach, you know, which a lot of people accepted. So in exchange for being told that, you know, a terrible thing that had happened in 9/11, that the response to it was this robust way of guaranteeing people's safety, that took precedence over people asking, is this okay, this place? Because it's kind of out of the way and it doesn't necessarily seem to conform with the way that we generally behave. So everybody was content to kind of throw away any concerns that I think they should have had about the law and how people are treated. And as you say, we've ended up in a position where far too many people don't even recognize the fundamental problem with it. Maybe they don't even know the thing that I've always been talking about for all of these years, which is that we're talking about people being deprived of their liberty. And when you take away someone's liberty, there are only two acceptable ways to do that unless you openly acknowledge that you're a dictatorship. And that is that you accuse somebody of a crime and put them on trial in a federal court, or you're a prisoner of war taken off the battlefield, in which case you can be held unmolested until the end of hostilities. And, of course, the people at Guantanamo are neither of these things and were initially held absolutely without any rights whatsoever as human beings, and only ended up getting rights because, you know, they were clawed back by lawyers acting on their behalf, trying to hold the Bush administration accountable. And yet, even after everything that's happened over all these years, Michael, those legal struggles that ended up with the prisoners getting habeas corpus rights in 2004, and then the Bush administration working with Congress to take them away, and then getting those habeas rights back again in 2008, and then having a few years where actually several dozen prisoners got released because the judges looked at the evidence and said that it was rubbish, and then the appeals court wading in and taking away those habeas corpus rights again, which, you know, rulings that still stand, so gutting habeas corpus of all meaning. And now Obama failed to close it, and now here we are with Trump, who has no intention of closing it, who, you know, said that he would love to send more people there if he could and would love to bring back torture. And really, what we're looking at is that the men still held at Guantanamo still fundamentally have no rights. They can't be released unless it's at the whim of the president, and the president has no interest in doing so. So it's really very fundamentally at odds with the entire basis on which we're supposed to understand that it's acceptable to imprison people. And I would say, really, that the 40 men who are still held at Guantanamo now are effectively the personal prisoners of Donald Trump.
And that's very heavy, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. You know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you is, we're talking about the conditions of the prisoners, though, is part of the thing that I think isn't really well known today, and I think it was better known in a decade ago, but still, even then, it was still, because this was a secret torture chamber that people knew existed, but they didn't know what happened within it. And this whole question of, basically, who are the prisoners, and what were the conditions then, and what are the conditions now?
Well, I mean, in some ways it's hard to know, because the place has never, ever been transparent. It's not as though anyone's ever been encouraged to have any proper insight into what's happening there. I mean, my feeling is that it's basically being run as a kind of zombie operation, where the military is told to continue behaving as though they're performing some incredibly important frontline mission against the most deadly terrorists in the world, when actually, although some of the people held there are genuinely accused of really serious crimes, what you've actually got is still a mixed bag of people accused of serious things and nobodies, people who are there just simply because they, you know, have had a bad attitude during their long and unjust imprisonment, all of whom are considerably older than they were when the prison began. And I think it's fair to say in most cases have aged even more than they would have done under any other circumstances of the passage of 17 years of time, because of the particularly horrible nature of the whole Guantanamo experience. Beyond that, I don't really know that we know that much about how they're being treated now. I mean, we don't, for example, know how many of them are on a hunger strike, because after the last large hunger strike, which took place under Obama in 2013, at the end of 2013, the military stopped reporting how many people were on a hunger strike. So the only way we can find out things now is through individual lawyers, and when they report that their clients are on a hunger strike, which is certainly true in a handful of cases. But I think what we're also seeing at Guantanamo now is prisoners just giving up on the entire process of believing that there's any way that they're going to be released. And I think some of them are not seeing anyone from the outside world now, so they're not meeting with the lawyers. They've kind of given up. And to be honest, you know, if you consider that when Obama was elected, apparently the whole prison was in jubilation because the prisoners thought they would be released, and that they had to put up with 8 years of that promise not being fulfilled. And now to find out that, you know, that their fate is in the hands of this monstrous man, Donald Trump, I can very readily see why people would fundamentally be giving up hope.
Yeah, absolutely. And along those lines, I kept thinking as you're talking, and I remember talking with you about this before, that people have to really recognize that one of the descriptions that you put out, I thought it was very important, that these people have been accused, but they've never been convicted of anything.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. The problem is, the two things that went wrong is that some of the people that they apprehended are accused of terrorism. The majority of the people that they apprehended, if it came down to them finding out anything about them, they seemed to be just foot soldiers who had been in Afghanistan and had come from a background where they'd probably been told that it was a good idea to go and join the Taliban in fighting against the Northern Alliance, this inter-Muslim civil war that was taking place before the 9/11 attacks took place. And yet the soldiers have never been held as soldiers, which would mean that they should have been released at the end of hostilities. And I think we could all make arguments that at various times between 2001 and now, waves of hostilities that have taken place in Afghanistan have come to an end. Certainly the ones connected with their imprisonment in the first place, which was the initial rule of the Taliban and the involvement of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan at that time. That's way gone. That's long finished. And yet these people are still held. And the problem for the people who are accused of having committed acts of terrorism is that instead of being dealt with in federal court, they've been put through this monstrously broken system that seems primarily to have been driven by Dick Cheney and his senior lawyer, David Addington, in the months after 9/11 and before Guantanamo was set up, of the military commissions, which just simply don't work. I mean, it's really like Groundhog Day in the military commissions. Mm-hmm. They just go round and round unable to progress to any kind of verdict, essentially. We've had a few plea deals over the years as the only way of being able to come to any conclusion with them. And all that we're stuck with in the rest is that on the one hand, we've got defense lawyers who are trying to bring evidence of these people's torture before the court because, correctly, they argue that there can be no justice unless the truth about what happened to these people is exposed. And on the other hand, the prosecutors working on behalf of the U.S. government have really only one aim, which is to consistently hide all evidence of the terrible things that were done to these people, and it goes nowhere. I mean, it's not helping anybody, and you know, justice isn't being done for any of these people. And I, again, think that the details of this have eluded far too many Americans who don't realize what's been done in their name at Guantanamo over the last 17 years and how fundamentally adrift this entire situation is from the norms of how people should be treated if they're going to be deprived of their liberty.
Right. And one of the most important questions that we're all faced with right now, and I think it's important that we dig into this in the time that we have left here, we are now dealing with a fascist regime. The Trump regime is a fascist regime. That doesn't bode well for the people sitting in Guantanamo right now. Let's talk about that.
Well, I mean, it doesn't. I mean, what it means on the most obvious basis is that because no one can get out of Guantanamo anyway, they're extremely unlikely to get out under Donald Trump. And, you know, we've seen that in his 2 years in office. Just one prisoner has been released, and he's a Saudi national who agreed to a plea deal in 2014 under Obama, whereby he was going to testify against other prisoners, and in exchange for that, he would be released after 4 years and sent back for ongoing imprisonment in Saudi Arabia. And he was released last year, although not promptly. I mean, he was released several weeks or months after the time that he was supposed to be returned to Saudi Arabia. But absolutely no one else has been freed, and there's no notion that he intends to do anything about that. The office of the envoy for Guantanamo closure, which was set up under President Obama, to do two important things, to negotiate with other countries about the release of prisoners and also to monitor release prisoners, which, you know, I think makes sense from a national security point of view, all shut down by Donald Trump. So no one is really in charge of Guantanamo. That's why I kind of likened it to a kind of zombie place that's just running on its own terms. What we've had so far, despite all of Trump's bombast about it, is that, you know, he hasn't sent anyone new to Guantanamo. And the reason for that is that people that have been advising him who are interested in outcomes have realized that if you want to successfully prosecute someone for anything that you allege that they've done, Guantanamo really is a hopeless case. It's not the place to do that. Because, as I was talking about, the military commission system is broken. It's a failure. And, you know, the fundamental truth about Guantanamo is that it wasn't really set up to have anything to do with justice. It was set up so that people would be beyond the reach of the U.S. courts so that the Bush administration could do whatever the hell it wanted to do with these people. And for 2.5 years, until the men got habeas corpus rights and lawyers were allowed in, finally, to start representing them, that is exactly what the Bush administration did. They did whatever they wanted, and it turned out that when they had all these people who they didn't really know anything about because they hadn't captured them on the battlefield, they'd largely bought them from their Afghan and Pakistani allies for bounty payments. They knew nothing about them. That when they couldn't get them to talk, that was when they started torturing them. So the whole thing is, you know, is a hideous mess. But what we've had to date is people of sounder mind than Donald Trump restraining his impulse to do far worse with the facility. What we obviously don't know at the moment is what's going to happen with the position of the defense secretary. Is Trump going to be able to bring people into positions of power and authority who share his absolute contempt for, not just for the law, but for, you know, practical considerations of what you do with the people that you call bad guys if you're not going to pursue it through the courts, as I think most sensible people would think you should do.
Now, Andy, we have just about a minute and a half left, so I want to ask you this. How can people, if people want to hook up with what you're doing and find out more about it, how can they do that?
Well, Well, if anyone's in the Washington, D.C. area, then I would urge them to come to the rally outside the White House, which is on Friday afternoon. I'm doing a talk at the New America think tank at lunchtime on the Friday, and then I'm doing a talk at Revolution Books in Harlem on Sunday. So that's for people in the New York area. More broadly, if people would be so kind as to go to the Close Guantanamo website, closeguantanamo.org, then they'll find information there about everything that's going on. I'm also running a poster campaign showing how many days Guantanamo has been open and urging Donald Trump to close it and asking people to take photos with that poster and to join this campaign of really just trying to make sure that Guantanamo isn't forgotten, Michael. I understand with all the terrible things that Donald Trump is responsible for, it's easy to see how it can be lost. But the fundamental injustice of Guantanamo is such a burning one, so important to our notions of justice, that it does need people to focus on it.
Mm-hmm. All right, Andy Worthington, thank you very much for joining us, and I look forward to talking to you again, although the next time, hopefully, Guantanamo won't be around.
Yeah, well, let's not hold our breath on that one, Michael, but yeah, it's all been right, great man. Talking to you.
You too, Andy. Thanks a lot, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Worthington. Andy is one of the foremost opponents of the long-standing Guantanamo torture chamber. He's a British journalist, among many other things, and has been out in front of waging a battle to shut this torturous monstrosity down. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank the people who worked on the show, my assistant producer Henry Carson, my production assistant Jeff Pryor, and engineer Gary Baca. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Talk to you again next week.
I waited all my life to play, but I still can't find a way. But if I work it one more day, I might just break the chain. I might just break the chain. I might just break the chain.
Especially where we from, where we grew up like a green thumbs, like a criminal, the only thing you can become. Look at what I became, something like a phenom, nothing but a G-thang. Things I've seen when I'm looking out of these frames, pictures I painted on the walls where we hang. From the trees we hung, strange fruit man, look at how we swung. How the hell you gonna tell a son who ain't have a father how to try to grow up and be one? Feel it in my bones and I'm sitting on the throne like a killer with the chrome. When I'm spitting out the poem, shed a whole lot of light on a little bit of home. Bam. Thought of as MIA, no paper planes. I'm flying, plus I don't write no more. But sort of on the top, I shave the brain to stay sharp. Man, I knew how to raise a blade.